difficult sell to make these people to admit what they did.
Yes, yes.
Racism is still there.
Well, I mean, the issue is, yes, on both counts. Yes, it was a difficult sell. Yes, racism is still there. But the challenge, of course, was how to get public access to dealing with this history critically. Right. So there were many, many interesting sort of encounters, and that's why at the beginning I said the film took me 8 years to make. In part was trying to convince the gatekeepers, not getting past the gatekeepers, but trying to get gatekeepers on side to persuade them to that this was indeed part of Canadian history and that it needed to be looked at critically.
Only that is phenomenon to come up with a film like this. Bravo.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry. I was just wondering, one of the credits was for Canadian heritage, and I was wondering, in light of what was asked earlier, how their response was to this, and so I assume you received some funding from them. I was wondering what section you got.
Interesting you asked that question. I forget now. I think it was, they used to have a multicultural fund, that's what it was. They had a multicultural film and video fund, which was, I believe, existed till about 2002, 2003. And what was interesting about that fund, as with the Canada Council, a lot of the support of my work comes from the Arts Council. I'm a really great believer in the system of the Arts Council, because it in a way sidesteps the very issue that you had raised, because the funding for the Arts Council comes from a jury of your peers rather than from bureaucrats, and that arm's length principle is something that as filmmakers and artists we really cherish. So what Heritage Canada had done was that they had set up a jury system emulating the Canada Council system. And that was what allowed me to get some funding from them.
If I can just add something to that, in another incarnation, I worked in Canadian Heritage at CSJ, one of the first things that I was asked to do, even before there was Canadian Heritage and a multicultural program, when he was Secretary of State, was to look at the claims for redress after the Japanese redress, the incident of Komagaramaro was one of the six claims, along with the Ukrainian, Chinese, and so on, Italian, ultimately nothing came of it. But certainly, at that point, after the Japanese redress, there was a mood in the federal government, in the federal bureaucracy that I guess I was within that at that point, where there was a certain openness to look at these incidents. And Hugh Johnson's book had just come out.
Okay.
And so I wonder if sort of the doors have closed again.
Well, the doors have not closed, but they've been opened in different ways and opportunistically so. So the six incidents, the six areas of redress that you mentioned were appropriated by the Harper government into a program called the Community Historical Recognition Program, which sought to, in a very cynical way, buy their way into the various communities. So I was part of I participated in a. They had several town hall meetings in 2006, in the fall of 2006. And one town hall meeting was held in Brampton, where there's a large South Asian population, as you know. And I attended the meeting. And what was astonishing to me was that this was so blatantly opportunistic and cynical. with all the, of course, all the people in Canadian Heritage, all the senior bureaucrats sort of co-opted to go along with this process, and sitting there with really literally shamefaced and embarrassed to be put in that position. So I did a personal intervention there, and in fact I had just joined York, so of course I knew that as an independent filmmaker, an intervention wouldn't, you know. Being a professor carried a different weight, so I used my professorial credentials to file an intervention. I had a meeting with Jim Prentice, who was chairing this session. I believe that was his name. He was an Alliance, a Reform MP, old Reform MP from Penticton. Knew nothing about the history, nothing whatsoever. So I essentially ended up educating him, the man who was chairing these sessions, about what had happened. And then out of that frustration evolved a second half of this project, which was to do a book, which is called Undesirables, White Canada and the Tuamotu Murray. And I have a few copies of those at a publisher's price, $20 for those of you who want to get them. But the reason for that intervention was precisely that all of the initiatives, all of the funding that came out of that program, you know, sort of disappeared. One hardly hears about what happened to all that, the $2.2 million that was given out. Of course, it just so happened that at my book launch, I got a letter from Canadian Heritage. Because one of the things that my wife, who was a project manager for that, and I had tried to do is make sure that we had full editorial control over the book. And then they started getting very worried. So the day before the book went to print, they said they sent me a letter claiming that the book was meticulously researched, but all that research was, the major flaw in the book was my personal opinions on current immigration and refugee policies, which marred the work. And they said, and this was the brilliant response, that because part of the book I refer to the St. Louis, that was the ship carrying European Jewish refugees that was turned back in 1939. They said it was absolutely incorrect for me to claim that Canada turned back to St. Louis. And I thought this was astonishing that you can actually put this on a piece of paper. That according to Canadian Heritage, and this was in 2011, Canada never turned back to St. Louis because the St. Louis never officially asked for permission to land. So for me to say that Canada had turned back the ship was a gross error, was a historically incorrect. And then, of course, I referred them to the two texts that have been written about, two important books that have been written on the subject. And I said thank you very much, and the book went to print. Of course, Jason Kenney didn't show up for his photo opportunity at the launch of the book. Very, very disappointed.
This is fantastic, for one. I was wondering if you could talk more about your process of doing the archival research, what you found first, what was hard to find, and also like comparing the different institutions that you must have had to look in. What was it like to work with them?
Thank you for asking that question. I owe a debt of gratitude to Hugh Johnston, who had, as we mentioned, had written a book on the subject, and there were others who had written books both in India and in Canada. And what I wanted to do was actually to get. I found all those texts framed this in sort of. In nationalist terms at the end. And the analysis was within these two nationalist frameworks, either in India or in Canada, and I wanted to try and get beyond that. So I spent a lot of time at the National Archives here, which was my primary source. I used the City of Vancouver archives, and I used some of the archives, long distance research in India, look at the National Archives in Delhi. So those were the three archival sources. Even though all these other texts had written, had used the same material, I wanted to go through the primary material myself. And so there was lots of information that I could, of course, as one does, glean from the primary text. And what part of the challenge of making this film, and I had been told this by the National Film Board, who I had approached very early on, and they had said, it's impossible to make this film because there's not enough visual material. How are you going to do it? There's about 24 photographs, there's no moving images, and we've tried doing it. It's impossible, we can't do it. And in fact, they kept me in development. This is one of the other things that filmmakers get trapped in, that you are relegated to development hell, as we call it. You're given a small amount of money, go research the project, and then you're constantly asked to redevelop your idea. So what I tried to do was to try and engage with the letters as both as not just for their text but also letters as all these documents also as objects. So that was part of the visual strategy. And then to try and find this moving image and finding it was a complete stroke of luck, fluke, providence, whatever. I put out a call. I worked very closely with archivists. One of the things I learned was that archivists are incredibly passionate about what they do, incredibly proud of their collections, deeply engaged in trying to get people to explore their collections, and I have tremendous respect and admiration for the work they do. And on that side note, the National Archives has been gutted by the current regime brutally, which I think is a national shame. So a friend of mine, Richard Fung, had done a film on early Chinese migration, and he'd got all this footage which had been sitting in my office for 5 years. It was on a professional format called Betacam, and I hadn't got it transferred to VHS, and I did in 2003. Now, there were several times in the 8 years where I thought I could not do this film. Doors being shut, feeling discouraged, feeling it was impossible, running out of money, and it was one of those moments where I thought, I can't do this, this is impossible. But I thought I would look at this tape that I had just got transferred. And as I was scanning through it, fast-forwarding through it, I saw the soldiers marching through the streets of Vancouver. I'd spent a lot of time in Vancouver. I recognized immediately this was Vancouver. And I knew that there was the soldiers were carrying ammunition belts around them as they did at the time, carrying live ammunition, which was not normal parade wear. And I thought, there's only one instance I know of in the 20th century when this has happened, which was the Congo-Bamaro. And as I was thinking that, the ship appeared. At which point I just sort of sat down, I wept, and I said, I knew I had to finish the film. So that was the...
Wow. Perseverance, that's what it is. Discussion, you can see this
struggle for independence and the racism and regulation of immigration all coming together on this ship. It's just really powerful. And in relation to that, I think I do have a question. I wonder the narrative, official narrative, and also popular narrative at that time. I think one is the racist, the discourse against kings, against Orientals, and the other is around them being revolutionary. Okay? So, do you see, is there a shift? You know, what's the story about these two discourses? Is there a shift, a difference, is there any change in the emphasis on these discourses? Like, did they start with racism first, and then gradually move to more fear about, revolutionary?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that question. So the revolutionaries, the security threat that was perceived by this population has largely been forgotten and ignored. So in the commemorations that happened last year for the 100th anniversary, there was a great deal of focus on the racism aspect of the story. Very little was engaged in terms of the revolutionary aspect of the population. In part because then we get into a lot of complications around identity, belonging, around the nature of the community today, about what happened to those revolutionary ideals, about how those parallel discourses of security threat and race continue to manifest themselves today. So there's a lot there. And it's interesting you say that as well in terms of the connection. One of the big challenges I had with TVO, who did finally come on board, because they were driven to come on board by their CEO at the time, was this linking the past and the present. One of the directors I was told by broadcasters was to keep the past in the past. Do not engage with the present. This was seen, of course, and then there was this great consternation around why are you bringing immigration policies of today? I said, because there's a continuity. It's in the title of the film. Well, that's your opinion. Exactly. It is my opinion. It is my perspective. It's a perspective that within Canada we have a tradition, and I've been part of the movement of documentary filmmakers that have fought for a particular definition of a documentary called a point of view, specific definition which includes point of view in funding. So within funding circles there is it's a creative documentary that has a point of view of the filmmaker. And the funding definition and the fact that we have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, do I have to bring that up? But yes, I do. Guarantees that I can make a film with my perspective in it. But this was a big issue. And also there was one of the things I tried to do was in the film, as you correctly pointed out, a lot of these histories and they're parallel histories, but they'll have a commonality to them. Are often very siloed. So what I tried to do was I tried to at least open up parallels and discussions between what were the geopolitical imperatives in dealing with the Japanese and the Chinese populations differently, but really with the same result. And this was seen as a problem as well. So because again, one of the directors was dumb it down. Really, broadcasters say this to you: dumb it down, keep it simple. You overestimate the intelligence of your audience. I said I respect my audience. Sorry. Sure.
Okay. So, thank you again for this film. It's really such a treat and to have your visit here. It's quite wonderful for us. I know that there were a number of Aboriginal activists who went out to provision the Komagata Maru And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that, and also about, you know, whether or not there were any furthered conversations between the two communities. What has been the ultimate history of that interaction and the intersectionality?
Well, you know, I actually have found no evidence and record of that actually states that there was that connection. I know this is something that's been brought up in the last couple of years by researchers and community activists in Vancouver. I have not come across any evidence of the provisioning by Aboriginal activists. What I did come across was a line in the, and which opened up a whole conversation for another piece that I did in 3D called Fair Play, was a line in one of the immigration officer letters that said that that Japanese fishermen are chartering their boats to help provision the ship. So, you know, which spoke to a particular kind of connectedness between these communities, and I imagine, I don't know what that negotiation was, what those conversations were, but certainly white fishermen were not going to charter their boats or allow their boats to be used to provision the ships, but the Japanese fishermen were doing it. In part, the other thing that, so I don't know, so the Aboriginal story, that I have, from both the South Asian side and the Canadian documentary record, and in fact the British documentary record, there's not a hint of any of that happening. Partly because the ship was under siege, it was a besieged ship. And the other thing that I didn't recognize, and I learned this very recently, in fact at a conference at IIT Kharagpur, where I met this Indian researcher who'd done a postdoc in Japan in Japanese literature, found the record, a book published by the ship's owner and chief engineer, which I also had, but I hadn't been able to get it translated because it was written in classical Japanese. But one of the things that his preliminary translation shows that the crew of the ship was very large, much larger than, because we in today's age we don't recognize how many crew members do you think were on that ship?
150. See how I don't know about ships?
55 people. So there was a crew of 55 Japanese sailors on the ship who had the freedom of going back and forth. Now that number is not mentioned, and I bring that up because that's such an empirical number. It's there, but even that record is not there in any of the documentary evidence. So yeah, so I would love to know if there was contact.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've heard.
Yes, I know. So have I. Actually, what happened last year was a wonderful event, and I was there for it. The Musqueam Nation did a welcome ceremony for the Komagata Maru at the 100th anniversary, and they held a traditional welcome dance and it was a phenomenal gathering, and to officially welcome the passengers of the Komagata. No,
it's okay. Yeah, come on.
I'm just curious to know about the reactions of the Indian community in Canada up to the film. Were they all positive? And also, if the film has been used as an educational material for the historical education of the Indian community in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The responses have been largely positive, and I say largely. There have been some exceptions taken to my engagement with the notion of secular India by Hindu nationalists who are here, who take great umbrage at me challenging the notion that India is a secular country, was a secular country. The biggest surprises I've had are from younger people, from young South Asians. And I'll give you one anecdotal engagement. This young man came to me, young Sikh man came to me after the film premiered at the Sikh Film Festival in Toronto. He's bearded, turbaned, very agitated, and finally got a chance to speak to me. And he said, I was born and raised in Edmonton. I wrap myself in the maple leaf. I'm as Canadian as they come. I have a shrine to Gretzky in my room. When I watched your film, for the first half hour, I said, this man is lying to me. My country did not do this to my people. And then he said, for the second half hour, I started getting really angry at the school system for not telling me any of this history. And then he said, I was really pissed off at my parents because they didn't tell me any of this. And he said, you've really messed me up. So and we laugh, it's interesting when I narrate this anecdote to a audience filled with young South Asians, many of them get up and say, that's exactly how I feel right now. So the film has been it's being used widely in the university system. It's used interdisciplinarily, so it's used in law, in migration studies, and history, in film courses. There is a shorter version of the film. There's an hour-long version of the film, which is a broadcast version of the film. It's 55 minutes, so that version is often used in schools. TVO did put out a study guide in Ontario schools to it, because part of their mandate was educational engagement with the documentaries they commissioned. So there were allies within TVO that put out a really good 4-page PDF that showed teachers how to engage with this history. The vast majority of the South Asian community, in spite of the commemoration of this event, knows very little about this history, very, very little about it. So the film continues to engage in part of that, and the book as well continues to try and engage in part of that conversation.
Yes, it was really, for me, a fantastic study of the dialectic of materialism and liberalism. Really coming together in a profound way, and how the way in which you position the film today, as in terms of re-narrating a kind of national narrative, which happens within, of course, the context of liberalism still, although the imperial part has for more or less receded in some way. And so I was curious if you would address the question of that problematic of how you see that gesture, which takes us back to Stuart Hall, was also trying to do how we could think of narratives of blackness within the context of Britishness, if you're British.
Right.
And so also, I think you're doing something similar in the Canadian context, in terms of reinscribing those narratives within the Canadian national narrative. If you could sort of push that in terms of what would you consider the state of things to be, for example, to then what your film might have contributed to that.
Well, thank you for that question. I mean, one of the things that I found fascinating about the Canadian nationalist narrative is that it tries to distance itself from notions of empire. Even today, when I talk to people, and I say, we use the word empire, there's a cringe, and people interject and say, well, you mean Commonwealth. And I have to remind people that before the Commonwealth, the notion emerged after the First World War, there was empire. and Canada was deeply implicated in empire, and the imperialist instinct is deep within the DNA of the country. It continues to manifest itself in the ongoing colonial engagement with Aboriginal people. And yet there's a, you know, so you have two banks, for example. You have I remember coming to Canada and being shocked at just the term, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. It profoundly grated me. I just thought, I looked at, and I could never go to bank at CIBC. It had this
imperialism.
It was, and everyone sort of just seemed to say, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. Empire, there's empire for you. Empire, and the corporate empire, right there in one of the iconic banks of the country, or the Toronto Dominion Bank, you know, the Royal Bank. All of these allude to notions of empire. The empire was out there, but no, there was a sense of. So what I wanted to do very much as part of this film was to bring back empire, and to bring back imperial concerns and imperial imperatives, and the real sense of that empire that you know, in many ways Canadian nationalism was also formulated out of getting away from imperial center in a particular way, you know. So there was this, so Canadian liberalism is trying to distance itself from empire through a process of self-determination, its own self-determination, which is based on whiteness, you know, very much so. And but yet there is this, race and empire continue to be underlying themes. And so all the texts that have been written, also what frustrated me was that they did not engage with empire. But when you look at all the documentation of the time, it was deeply engaged with empire. I mean, Canada did not have, this is before the First World War, Canada did not control its own foreign policies. You know, they were controlled by the imperial center.
Now, to prove that we're tainted with the ancient impression of non-existent empire, I've invited 15 people to come here today. Where are they? It's still there.
Oh, yeah.
We must have told them, don't go there because this is too controversial. I tried on this. And I didn't do it on purpose. I just thought, you know, I figured there's 15 people that are interested in this, but I don't see it.
Too controversial.
Well, I mean, that's the general opinion. I mean, people don't want to admit that we did what we did as a country.
But I think, absolutely, and my response to that is that can't figure out what you're doing right now unless we know what we did. And there's a lot of it still continuing.
I have a question about the stylistic aspect.
Please.
I noticed that you are trying to create a movement with the still images, mm-hmm. and then you use the animation techniques as well, like, you know, the blinking the mm-hmm. eyes and stuff like that. And then also you mentioned that originally you created this for the television. So then down was the you know, expression you got. But at the same time, I have been reflecting on the Asian documentary, mm-hmm. and then the recent current is very much Philip Wiseman's influence for the observational documentary mm-hmm. being very fashionable. Mm-hmm. So then many of the documentary makers in Japan, mm-hmm. when they make the critical the documentary, they use the instead very television dumbed-down style mm-hmm. to make appealing to the wider audience. Mm-hmm. What was your choice, like when you were, you know, producing the ADS, this documentary? What kind of, like, you know, the struggle did you have in terms of defining what the documentary style is?
Thank you. It's a part of this documentary style. Yes, I mean, you know, as documentary filmmakers, we are constantly debating this sort of notion of truth and reality and purity of documentary and style. So, Frederick Wiseman, for those of you who don't know, is a great icon of the documentary movement. He's in his late 80s now, still continues to do observational films in a style called cinema verite, which is pure observational style, where you so-called pure. But the notion being, if you just let the camera roll, you get close, something closer to truth. It's a claim that I disagree with profoundly, and it's a claim that I also feel really what it does is that it seeks to absolve the filmmaker of accountability and responsibility to a point of view, and yet it says that the film doesn't have a point of view because it's observational. Observing something does not have a perspective or point of view. So I know. So for me, my work tends to be problematic for a number of documentary filmmakers. A, because it doesn't fall into that fashion and the trend of what is considered pure documentary. B, I'm a bit old-fashioned because I tend to make work that is politically engaged. And which is a very difficult sell for a broadcast audience. But at the same, having said all that, I'm a filmmaker, I'm an artist, and I want to have, and I see film as a visual language, and I see film as also be giving the possibility of visual pleasure, and working at different layers. There's a visual layer, but there's also an oral layer to it. There's a whole soundtrack that people don't think about, and they're not meant to think about it. But there's a multi-layered sound design in the film that seeks to immerse you in a particular moment in different ways. So I work at all those levels, and part of the visual style over the years emerged as an act of desperation. Because this was a problem that we had, these massive gaps, literally black holes in our timeline of the film. My editor would look at me and say, "Now, what do we do? How do we do this?" And I did not want to use one of the other stylistic trends within historical documentary is to use a pan and scan, you know, which are now outrageously called the Ken Burns move, although the National Film Board of Canada was doing that 30 years before Ken Burns did it, or doing reenactments, you know, using actors to reenact, which on a shoestring budget tends to be very, very illustrative, and really, I wanted to give the audience lots of space to really put themselves in the image, to think through ideas at whatever level they wanted to. So I came up with this thing of trying to do these photo montages. And I saw a film called The Kid Stays in the Picture, which is about an American Hollywood producer that was made entirely with this technique, although they had $1.5 million to do it. And then my editor and I basically sort of reverse engineered the style to a desktop technology. But what we wanted to do was to try and still keep it cinematic. So we used a lot of filmic techniques, even with the cutouts. So a simple technique that we use as filmmakers is pulling focus from the background to the foreground. And I do that within the frame of the cutouts. So I locate these figures in a virtual three-dimensional space. And then the virtual camera pulls focus, as we say technically, from someone in the background to someone in the foreground. So there are these little visual language cues throughout the film, and the style then became also there was a thing around names. One of the part of the frustration around dumbing it down was I was told nobody will remember these names. You know, these are all strange names that Canadians are not used to. I know, but we have to listen to the stuff as filmmakers when we go to the gatekeepers. So So my editor, in this moment of frustration, put Gurdit Singh's name in this bold, oversized type. I said, great, let's do that. You know, it was one of those things where it's a, it's a collaborative process, and it's also a bit of a joke and a shock to the system, its visual style. And the White Canada Forever song, for example, it's a song that I really really wanted to just to put the subtitles like a karaoke song. So just in case you weren't getting it and you want to sing along, you had the karaoke version lyrics there to it. So in the midst of all this, I wanted to be playful and keep visual and oral pleasure throughout the whole process.
Well, it's an art situation, and you did that, I guess, to relieve the tension, because, it's, I mean, for me as a comedian, I find this very difficult to know, and to not have known at 65 that this happened. Like the young man, the young Sikh man who said, you know, like, I was never taught that in history. You know, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, well. We can continue this conversation over lunch, so please everyone join us, room 3112, so up the stairs and that one.
Thank you.
Thank you.